From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the weekend at Claremont Graduate University in Southern California, a group of scholars gathered to discuss what it means to be religious and free in the 21st century. It was an incredibly wide-ranging discussion about history and the law and politics, and there were some basic questions being asked. Among them, what is the role of religion in the public square? The weekend included a keynote address from Elder Dallin Oaks of the LDS Church. Oaks said he believed the United States was moving strongly towards secularism. But if religion is losing its influence in the public sphere, how much of that is religion's own fault? And what are the boundaries of religious liberty? Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation from the Religious Liberty Conference, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to broadcast a conversation we had over the weekend with legal and religious scholars about religious liberty. We were invited to participate in a conference held by Claremont Graduate University in Southern California. Some churches have been particularly worried about religious freedom in the wake of the Supreme Court's ruling that legalized same-sex marriage. Some of the questions we talked about were these. Just what is the role of religion in the public square? Does religion deserve special protections like speech? Does a religion have a right to discriminate? There were four people on the panel. Kathleen Flake, a religious studies professor at the University of Virginia. The Reverend Steve Peters, a retired pastor who is openly gay and an AIDS activist. Monica Miller is senior counsel with the American Humanist Association. Her focus is the separation of church and state. And Michael Uhlman was with us, a professor of policy and politics at Claremont Graduate University. He's had a distinguished career in government, including a stint in the Department of Justice. We began with a question, which I took from a presentation made earlier in the conference. One of the participants said that religious liberty in this country was in jeopardy. He said storm clouds were coming. So I began by asking what it was that religious people were worried about exactly. Professor Kathleen Flake went first.
Well, I think in a word, they're worried about the loss of freedom to be who they are. There's a long history to it, of course, beginning at least by the 1960s with the prayer cases. So they feel excluded from the larger public dialogue on things that they feel deeply about, and not simply as a matter of passion, personal passion, but their sense of what is real, what is the most real about life. And so it's a contest of worldviews, both as to values and as perception, and they feel that their perceptions, their values, are being excluded and done with the power of American law.
Reverend Peters, what do you think? Have you boiled it down to what you think they're really worried about?
Well, I think a lot of religious people are worried about being erased and their opinion not counting in the public sphere, I think that's true in the LGBT community as well. We who are the religious LGBT community fear that our voices will not be heard or will be discounted and vocally disagreed with and shouted down.
Professor Geddix of Brigham Young University in a presentation yesterday said it stretched the imagination to say that a clerk issuing a marriage license to a gay couple is going to one day mean that religions will be forced to solemnize same-sex marriages in churches and temples. So what are they worried about? Monica Miller, what do you think? What are they worried about?
You know, I think he was exactly right when he said that, because there is that distinction between the community sphere, the public sphere, and the private sphere. And I think while there might be concern that the secularists, if you will, are trying to push the the private sphere into the public sphere so that that stuff can be regulated, the courts have been, if anything, moving more towards the direction of more exemptions and more accommodations. So I don't know if the concern is necessarily valid, and I think that's exactly right. When you're a public employee, you have an obligation to the public, all citizens, to uphold the law. And when the Supreme Court says that the law is that you have to issue the marriage license, you don't have an individual right to refuse that license on the grounds of your personal religion. You can just not hold that job if you feel that way. But it's the distinction is a minister, a private individual, versus a government official. To me, it's a clear delineation.
Michael Uhlman, on that same question, how are you thinking about that?
Well, I wasn't here yesterday, so I don't know specifically what Professor Geddick said. But as for myself, I have no confidence whatsoever, having read the opinion Obergefell, that the state, in fact, is going to leave religious people alone. On the contrary, I think we're in for a period of some rather aggressive and nasty politics before this issue is resolved. I will mention only one point, and that is during the oral argument, Justice Alito asked the Solicitor General, what about tax exemptions for religious institutions? And Solicitor General really said, we'll have to look into that. That is one of the most ominous sentences ever articulated in front of the Supreme Court, and that's why I have no confidence whatsoever as to any optimistic scenario that may unfold in the coming years. I pray I'm wrong.
Kathleen Fink, what did you make about that? That was one of the things that Alexander Dushku yesterday was talking about in his presentation. He mentioned that some of the core rights of religious liberty were at stake. And he mentioned, number one, tax-exempt status. The right of employment, he also mentioned, to have religious views that wouldn't disqualify you from being employed, for example. Are these really practical things that they're worried about then in the wake of
rulings? I don't think people are crazy for worrying about that. I understand Monica's point. Of course, she knows, too, that the question's going to become one of how do you define the private and how do you define the public. Many people feel that that definition is loosening so that the private is being invaded by a robust sense of the public, particularly with respect to, as we all know, this is what's lurking in this conversation, the wedding cake cases and et cetera, et cetera. But do people have a basis for worry? I think if they do, it comes from the Bob Jones case under the Reagan administration, actually, where even though everybody loved the result, which was everybody thought Bob Jones was being racist by not allowing interracial dating, at the same time, everybody was worried about how they got to regulating that, which was jerking their tax exemption. So that case is a worry to lawyers as well, not just a worry to people in the present debate about Obergefell. So there's a wrinkle in the law that's going to have to be ironed out in this climate. People are wondering who's going to hold the iron and what it's going to mean.
Monica, should their tax exemption be reconsidered in light of some of these questions?
That's a good question. From our standpoint in the secular community, we sometimes see it as a special exemption sort of without a purpose. The American Humanist Association is a nonprofit that has similar functions as sometimes a church, but we don't have that same exemption simply because we don't profess a belief in God. So in our perspective, at times it almost feels like an arbitrary grant just because one has a deity involved and our community doesn't. So I think if there are exemptions, they need to be extended to the religious and the non-religious in the same way. I can't predict the law, but I don't see anytime soon the tax exemption going away, so I don't see any need to worry about it because I don't think the Supreme Court would, at least as it was, within the last couple of years, would uphold such a repeal of the tax exemption because it's been so longstanding.
Could I respond to something that you just said, Monica, that the only difference between the Humanist Association and religion is that one is theistic and one is not?
It's definitely one of the core.
Well, you said that was the difference between the two. I think the thing that has to be considered in this kind of argument is that the word religion is used in the Constitution, and so it's more than simply theism. It's constitutional law, right, that must be dealt with in distinguishing between an association and a religion.
Well, and I tend to agree on some level, but I do think that a lot of the organizations now that are seeking exemptions are hospitals and schools and are not purely houses of worship.
Now, those are for philanthropic purposes or because they're engines of the state, right? Those are distinctions made independent of their religious content, but based on other public kinds of public or other kinds of policy. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can make a difference. But what I'm saying is that there's an expansion from the religious institutions that are trying to seek these exemptions and seek these benefits that traditionally were reserved for houses of worship.
Professor Flake, are you talking about the fact that the First Amendment provides for special protections?
Well, that's the question.
Yeah.
And so you see many law review articles saying, is religion special? The quick rejoinder is, well, the Constitution makes it special, and what's your next point?
Whether it should be or not, it is.
Yeah. And so what does that special mean, and what kind of rights come with that constitutional recognition?
One more of those concerns that was raised by Alexander Dushku yesterday. He said, there is a risk that those who adhere to traditional religious beliefs will become social pariahs. Michael Uelman, is that overwrought a bit, or do you think that's
No, I don't think it is. I think there's already some risk of that. Depends on the aggressiveness with which litigating groups, especially but not exclusively, gay rights organizations, pursue the agenda which the Supreme Court has rather openly invited them to pursue. Not just tax exemptions. It's a whole series of problems relating to public accommodations, for the provision of social services, just to mention one passing note. The state of Massachusetts has become very aggressive on this, and for all intents and purposes, Catholic and other organizations in the adoption business have been driven out of business because they will not place their children in gay households. And whatever you may think about that as a matter of policy, as a matter of constitutional law, it is novel, and it is very hostile toward religious organizations, and if you are a representative of a religious organization, you have every reason to be very worried.
Monica Mill, you want to respond to that?
Well, issue? I don't think it's novel. A lot of the same-sex issues in the gay rights movement have been focused on equality and the Equal Protection Clause as opposed to the First Amendment. And I think when we look at the principles of equality that underlie those decisions of the Supreme Court, we don't see anything novel. We see the Supreme Court time and again saying, you know, that the government can't sanction discrimination either on arbitrary basis or because of immutable characteristics, because, you know, discrimination is abhorrent to our society. So I think that the government's interest in preventing discrimination of all kinds is important, and that when an entity enters the marketplace or is providing a service to the public, that it needs to follow the law. And if the law says you can't discriminate, then that's what you can't do. You can pull out from that market, but when you're in that realm of community rights versus private rights, you need to abide by those rules.
That's a little more complicated because in the vernacular, commerce is definitely a public activity. Whether in a legal sense it constitutes a zone of public regulation is another question. Even in the civil rights laws that serve so much of the model for what we think discrimination and non-discriminatory activity is, even they allowed for private discrimination as they sought to dismantle the institutionalization of racism. And to the extent that there is an institutionalization of homophobia, and then absolutely there is a public sphere that needs to be dismantled. But as to private racist activity, we tolerate a great amount of it in this country, and much of it in the economic market. And in fact, again, arguably, the free market, like free religion, are the two sacred cows of America. And the free market relies upon the voluntary activity of its participants in order to succeed and remain healthy. And so for the government to enter into an economic market has always been very fraught for us. Not that we can't. We do it with antitrust, but we do it where there is some kind of restraint on the market acting freely, right? That's where government tends to intervene, not on moral issues. But the market has its own rules and its own law. And you cannot just say, because people, masses of people are engaged in it, it is therefore public under the definition of the law.
So religions have a right to discriminate?
Legally, I would say yes. Morally, I would say no. At what point does the law and public morality join so that the police powers of the state are available to enforce a particular moral view? That's the question we're talking about.
Can I use a case from 1968? I'm sure a lot of you know this case. This was a case that came before the Supreme Court. A South Carolina barbecue restaurant owner invoked his religion to keep black people, African Americans, from his restaurant. He said it went against his religious principles to allow them to come into his restaurant. Right. Did he have a right to discriminate? And how is that different from a case today related to same-sex couples?
Very good question. They reached Ollie's Barbecue through the Commerce Clause. And the anti-discrimination statutes were largely affected through the power of the purse, program or activities that receive federal funding. So there's no question that governments enter into the market. But again, that was a question of systemic racism, Jim Crow laws, and they went to extraordinary means to reach it. Now, whether the court will decide there exists in the United States the kind of systemic discrimination against homosexual activity, or in particular gay marriage, whether they will seek to intervene in those marks at the same degree, I don't know, but context is everything in this respect.
How is the context different?
Systemic discrimination.
You don't think it rises to the level of systemic discrimination?
I don't know, and I'm
Monica Miller,
sure.
Do you?
I don't see why that matters. I mean, I think that if it's discrimination and it's on a prohibited basis, it shouldn't matter if it's, you know, located in California only or if it's global. I don't think that's ever been the test. It's whether it's against the law. And I think, speaking of the Commerce Clause, what we're actually talking about in these types of cases, like the public accommodation, is the ability for Congress to enact statutes that provide those accommodations or that provide those rules. So in those cases, like, they'll define a place of public accommodation by, say, you know, 20 or more employers, or, you know, they have the definition sort of built in. And so really it's not even a free exercise versus the Establishment Clause or versus the Equal Protection Clause. We're just talking about an act of Congress and whether it has that authority.
Reverend Peters, forgive me for keeping you out of the conversation so far. Okay. Do you have anything to say about this particular point?
Well, you know, I'm not terribly familiar with the legal ins and outs of all of this and the case law and all of that, but I do know how my brothers and sisters in the LGBT community have been hurt by discrimination and have been affected by discrimination, and it is never easy, and it is always distressing, and one would hope that we would be treated equally under the law in terms of being protected in areas of public accommodation and employment and as well as in same-sex marriage issues.
But what if that comes in conflict with a person's conscience?
Well, as Monica was saying, if they are providing a public service, then they are bound by the laws, and the laws in many places protect us. Unfortunately, this week, sweeping anti-LGBT laws were passed and signed into law in North Carolina, and it's very distressing that in one state we're being told that we don't have rights, the same civil rights that my fellow panelists have, and yet in another state we do. And, are we going to need to keep a guidebook of which states we can safely go to?
But this goes to the question of the systemic nature of the discrimination. I feel the suffering of that is cumulative from years of discrimination. And I don't want to sound unsympathetic when I speak in terms of legal process. I don't know that I have more civil rights than you do. What I have is personal opportunity to find lodging. That's what I mean by a kind of process answer to your question. I think when I go to Georgia, I don't have to think about this. The burden that you have is that you have to think about whether that bed and breakfast will allow you and your husband to stay there. I don't have to worry about that, except finding husband. That's what I have to worry about. What I'm trying to say is I'm inviting some thought about what it means to be public and what it means to be private as a way to get out of this zero-sum game, that if religion is protected, then somehow gay rights are harmed. And if gay rights are furthered, somehow religion is harmed. That zero-sum game does not offer us a way forward any more than it did on race. But that's the distinction I'm asking for. I'm not by any means trying to justify a personal behavior that I consider reprehensible towards gay and lesbian people or couples. I'm wanting to hear the argument that there is not an alternative for when you go to Georgia, that there are not sufficient alternatives to protect your right to dignity, to get accommodations.
Well, if it comes to the point where we need to go to strictly LGBT-friendly B&Bs, I fear that it will move us towards ghettoization.
You can stay at the Marriott Hotel. The Mormon Marriott Hotel welcomes you, right?
Really? Okay.
So that's what I'm talking about. There are alternatives that may or may not be, depending on the arguments that are made, and I'm open to it, may not be enough to say the Marriott, the Hilton, the Sheraton are all there in Georgia and welcome your business on the principles of market that drive the market. They want your business. That's why they're thundering against the Georgia legislature on this, right? Mm-hmm. The power you have in the market is one of the measures of your opportunity.
But how much power do we have in the marketplace, given that we are maybe 10% of the population?
Well, that's what's so striking. Maybe at 10% you have this kind of power to mobilize Disney Corporation.
Well, that's true. We have
Disney,
a lot of friends
the
at
Disney. The
family-friendly
corporation is mobilized.
Yes, absolutely.
By your plight.
We have a lot of people.
So, yeah. Professor Flake, what you're saying is you don't need a law when the market will take care of it?
Well, the law becomes symbolic at this point, and the question is whether the exercise of that law is strategic.
Right. Monica Miller, do you want to comment on... And Michael, I want to get you on these matters, too.
I mean, there's a few things. I think that we have to think about what the law actually says and what it doesn't. I think for bed and breakfasts, I think they might even be exempt from a lot of the public accommodation laws because Congress cannot reach a certain level if it hasn't affected interstate commerce.
There was a bed and breakfast that went out of the business because of this issue in
New
England.
Okay, mm-hmm. So the state had the ability. What I'm saying, though, is that this is an issue of statutory law that can be upheld on the basis of a compelling governmental interest in prohibiting people from feeling like they're not welcome because of something that they can't control. To me, it seems kind of like a non-issue because we're not talking about houses of worship right now. We are talking about places of public accommodation, which by definition have to extend their services according to the laws.
So does this get to a bigger point of there's a difference between a public sphere and a private sphere? Michael?
Yeah, I have a few things to say here. One, I don't think, with all due respect to Stephen, that the gay community need worry at the moment about its powerlessness. It owns the academy, it owns the media, and it owns the Supreme Court. That's almost game, set, and match on every important issue now facing the body politic on these issues. I wouldn't worry on that account. Number two, I think one has to be careful about tossing words like discrimination out loosely as if everybody understood the meaning of the term, both in common sense terms and in terms of the law. In fact, not every discrimination is necessarily wrong, morally or legally, and even if it were, not everything that is wrong, morally or legally, should necessarily be unconstitutional. You have to make very careful distinctions in this area. In any event, the issue with the gay marriage cases and those which preceded it has a great deal more to do with matters other than discrimination per se. The core philosophical issue in these cases, which it's the majority of the court made into a constitutional issue, is whether it is licit constitutionally to entertain views that doubt gay marriage. Justice Kennedy in Romer versus Evans, a case of some years ago in Colorado, described the opposition to gay rights and gay marriage as arising from an irrational animus, quote unquote. If that is the case, then Western civilization, since at least the time of Christ, has been immoral. I don't believe that is true. I don't believe it's true now, and I don't think it's a matter of constitutional cognizance. If you want to change the rules on that subject, the place to do it is via legislatures. But if legislatures are stopped from commenting on this issue, which essentially they have been with some minor exceptions, then they too, because they too are guilty of an irrational animus. That's the box the Supreme Court has put the culture in, and that's why people of religious sensibility have every reason to be worried about what the future holds.
Well, here too, I respect your personal pain on this as I do my gay brothers and sisters. But the case has been decided. We now obey the law of the land. The question is, what is the reach of that law, and how can we negotiate that reach with existing legal principles to accomplish a sense of comity, a sense of cooperation among these two disparate moral orders, which is what the whole enterprise of America has been politically, is negotiating multiple moral orders. But the court has decided this, and religion's duty at this point has
been. Doesn't it seem like you are in agreement about multiple moral orders, at least related to same-sex relationships and perhaps even homosexuality in general? There is a sort of a moral absolute here? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm trying to get at what Kathleen originally said, with which I agree with. About how do you maintain an atmosphere of civility? If you take seriously the proposition, as aggressively advocated by Justice Kennedy, that opposition to gay rights or gay marriage in particular is a product of an irrational animus, right? That is a declaration of war. That makes civil discourse very difficult going ahead. And if there's a continued kind of aggressiveness on this front, then a whole series of challenges are going to be confronted by people of religious sensibility in public accommodations, in the provision of social services, in employment rights. And if it moves from the premise, not just of discrimination per se, which we can deal with, but on the assumption that my views are irrational and immoral, that's a declaration of war, and there's no civil way out of that fight until the other side backs down. That's the dilemma we're in at the present hour until the Supreme Court changes its mind, and you should be under no delusions about that.
Reverend Peters, you want to say something?
First of all, I sit here as a representative of the gay and lesbian religious community, and our faith is as deep and as profoundly felt as any of yours, our personal faith. And I believe that God loves us, gay and lesbian people, just the way we are, and that God loves and celebrates our loving relationships. Jesus never said a word about homosexuality. So I think claiming from the time of Christ as an argument, with all due respect, is not a valid argument. I mean, from the time of Christ, people believed in slavery. And we don't hold that. Morals have changed around slavery, certainly, and around women's rights and issues. And I think things are changing around gay and lesbian rights as well as transgender rights. And so I think we have to be very careful about making moral absolutes, which it sounded to me like you are making. And in terms of the animus, we have certainly felt a great deal of what we perceive of as irrational animus directed towards us in many instances by religious folk. And I have personally had to pick up the pieces from a lot of formerly religious gay and lesbian people who were damaged and thrown out by their churches and their families on religious principles. And so the human toll of such animus is very real.
Steve, nothing I said should imply in any way, shape, or form any toleration for mean-spirited behavior, whether it comes from religious sensibility or any other kinds of sensibility. And clearly people in the gay community have been maltreated by all sorts of people unjustifiably. No argument on that front. And I have every reason to believe that, for all I know, the long line of gay and lesbian people way ahead of me at the pearly gates. That's not the issue. The issue is that if you tell me that there is no rational ground on which a good human being can oppose gay rights or gay marriage, then there's no basis for a conversation.
Oh, no.
That's what the Supreme Court has said.
Can I speak to that? I actually strongly disagree. That's what the Supreme Court held in the Romer versus Evans case. What the Supreme Court held was actually that this law that was passed by Colorado initially prohibited discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And then the same state decided to take that, scratch sexual orientation from the protections of that anti-discrimination law. So effectively, they were stripping the law of a protection that they were according to women and to racial minorities. And so the Supreme Court was looking at a very narrow issue of whether the law of striking sexual orientation as a basis of discrimination had even a rational basis. And the Supreme Court said that it didn't have a rational basis because there was no reason, it was arbitrary, to remove gays and lesbians from the protection, the ambit of this law. So I don't think that Justice Kennedy was waging a war on religion when he said that it was irrational for the state of Colorado to take away this protection.
That's Monica Miller, senior counsel at the American Humanist Association's Legal Center. We also heard from Kathleen Flake, the Richard L. Bushman Chair of Mormon Studies at the University of Virginia. Reverend Steve Peters is a retired pastor of Metropolitan Community Church, works as an AIDS activist, and Michael Ewellman, a professor of policy and politics at Claremont Graduate University. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about whether religious liberty in this country is being limited or is in some way under threat. We're broadcasting a conversation from a religious liberty conference held over the weekend in Southern California at Claremont Graduate University.
How much, I mentioned this in the introduction, how much should religion itself take some of the blame for its diminished role in the public square? I mean, if this is a free market, is religion picking the wrong things to emphasize? It's something that Elder Oaks mentioned last night. He mentioned a Washington Post editorial. Let me quote some of it. He talked about where a university professor's recital of these instances where official and social pressure, and here's the quote, forced religious adherents to behave better, and over time, the religions themselves changed their doctrines and belief systems to conform to society's demands. This editorial said, "We are at one of those moments in history when pressure from the larger society pushes against religious beliefs and insists that believers, at least when doing business with the public, not act even on sincere objections to same-sex marriage." So the question of whether or not it's religion's fault, because they're not updating their doctrines, updating their ideas. What do you, Monica Miller, you want to start with that one? Is it their own fault in some way?
That's a good question. I don't see it that way. But I also don't accept the premise, I guess. Certainly we're seeing a secularization of America, the rise of the nuns, we like to call it. But I think increasingly from the Supreme Court, we're seeing more and more religious accommodations. I don't know if I accept the premise, I guess.
Then how about this premise, that millennials tend to be fleeing religion because they're uncomfortable with these old ideas and these old orthodoxy, and they're maybe taking up religion, but in a different way, something that's more appealing to them.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's completely their right to do so. I think because of that, we are seeing religions trying to, I don't want to say insert themselves in the government sphere, but they are trying to get more accommodations and be more present to get more followers, I think. So we're sort of seeing that reciprocal relationship. Is it their fault? I don't know. I can't speak to that per se, but I do think that it would behoove them to consider maybe being more inclusive if they're after numbers.
Professor Flake, what do you think? If this is a marketplace, then they're losing people. They're doing something wrong in the market. No?
Well, even though I sound like a lawyer up here, I'm really a professor of religious studies, so this is a question that we talk about all the time, and so class will begin, and we'll go for about 50 minutes. But I think that's a simplistic conclusion. I think it's much more complicated, of course. One of the ironies is studies show that it is the higher-boundaried religions, the religions that are able to identify themselves over against culture, that have the staying power. The idea that you succeed culturally by responding to the culture is not defensible by the studies I know.
That doesn't work for people. They want to see you standing your ground. Is that what you're saying?
It's not just they want to see you standing their ground. Religion represents another reality. To the extent that you cease to represent that reality, then people feel no need to affiliate with you because they might as well just go about their normal, everyday lives without any sense of the transcendent over against the everyday. And one of the ways freedom of religion has survived has been subordinating religion to the state by placing it into a market where it was a voluntary society of like-minded people. And ever since that moment of disestablishment, religions have had to prove themselves to the public. One proof has been, we are moral, therefore associate with us because our morality is good. Therefore, as the morality changes, then the morality in the church has to change. If your appeal is not essentially a moral one, but a sacramental one, meaning we can connect you with the holy, and our morality is downstream from that, then that's a whole different, if you will, brand on the market. So if your appeal to the world is, we are sacramental, we mediate the divine, then you are going to not find your direction or your moorings based on the ethical commitments of your culture, and hence you need the protection that the First Amendment gives that says the government will make no law respecting the eternal. Does that make sense?
It does.
Establishment clause.
Reverend Peters, what do you think to that question? Should religion, this is something that Elder Oaks is clearly concerned about, he mentioned this last night, that religions ought not to be in the role of revising their doctrines just to keep up. But don't all religions change in some way and keep up in some way?
Absolutely. I think that, I'm constantly seeing, not just in my denomination, but other Protestant denominations, at least, that I'm familiar with, there's a constant movement towards change as we seek to change our governance or as we seek to change our understandings of morality or scripture. There has been a great deal of change in mainstream Protestant churches, in many of them, around the gay and lesbian issues. And I think there is absolutely life in that. And I think without change, we grow stale. Now, there is, too, a place for tradition. And, of course, we respect the traditions. And we in MCC subscribe to a traditional apostolic understanding of our creed. Tradition does hold a place, and we take our tradition seriously as we consider how we are moving into the future.
Michael, you've talked a lot about natural law, the idea that certain rights or values are inherent by virtue of human nature, and that there are these universally recognizable, just through reason, values that could come into play with natural law. I wanted to have you talk a little bit about that with this idea of should religions or should they not adjust their thinking, their doctrines, their dogma.
Religions do change their dogma somewhat, but mainly at the margins. It depends on the church in question. But I had rather thought one of the central purposes of religion was to try to accommodate the world to its teachings and not the other way around. It's a paradox worth noting. It seems to be the case that those religions which are growing in numbers are those religions which demand more rather than less of their adherents, both doctrinally and in terms of personal behavior. Whereas, by sharp contrast, the mainline churches, for example, are rather sharp decline. On the issue of natural law, I think ultimately the organization of civil society has to proceed along the lines of a natural law kind of basis rather than a doctrinal basis. I say this because the dilemma we're facing is a modern, postmodern restatement of one of the oldest arguments, and if not the oldest argument, when it comes to church-state relations. Christ himself recognized this very clearly in the famous passage where he says, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." For good or ill, he did not give us a 13-volume appendix that differentiated it. And in a way, the whole story of Western civilization is an effort to work out and delineate the meets and bounds of that relationship. What Christ did in that moment was to dignify the civil order on what is essentially a natural law ground, saying the civil order is entitled to a kind of decency and respect within its proper sphere. At the same time, he said the religious order is entitled to decency and respect and dignity within its proper sphere. Now, how do you differentiate between the two? This is essentially a philosophical exercise. It's not something that the churches per se have a right to define, and it's not something that Caesar per se alone has a right to define. That's the role that natural law plays in this area, and it reaches, in my view, its apogee in the deliberations of the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment, and in that provision in Article 6, which is seldom talked about, but in a way sheds the greatest light on Article 1, it's the prohibition against any religious test for federal office. That, so far as I know, is the first time in the history of the world where such a provision was put into a constitution. That's the ground norm that we should follow. It's a natural law kind of proposition. Why should that be? In articulating why this should, that should be, you would once set the grounds on which you can have an intelligent and civil conversation between Caesar and God. That's the dilemma facing every civilization that ever was and facing us today in a rather more radical form.
So that was Madison splitting the difference between what's Caesar's and what's God's? Was it Madison?
No, but it's an instantiation of the principle.
Huh.
The American Revolution and the Constitution that follows came in the wake of a long period of religious warfare in which religious adherents slaughtered one another by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. It was an effort to delimit that by removing certain spheres of religious activity from the public sphere, on the one hand, on the other, at the same time, limiting the authority of Caesar to interfere in the internal activities of churches and the right of free exercise. It seeks to strike a balance between the claims of Caesar and the claims of religion, on the other hand, and it is a noble effort. Right? It's the noblest effort of any kind that has ever been established, in my view, in the history of civilization.
That's Professor Michael Uhlman of the Claremont Graduate University. We're also hearing from Professor Kathleen Flake of the University of Virginia. Monica Miller is a senior counsel with the American Humanist Association. And Reverend Steve Peters is a retired pastor of Metropolitan Community Church. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation recorded live at a conference on religious liberty at Claremont Graduate University in California. We had with us on the panel Kathleen Flake, a religious studies professor at the University of Virginia, the Reverend Steve Peters, a retired pastor and an AIDS activist. Monica Miller is senior counsel with the American Humanist Association, and Michael Uhlman is a professor of policy and politics at Claremont Graduate University.
Well, I want to head to some sort of wrapping up points here in a moment, but Monica Miller, I wanted to hear you on something else, something that you had mentioned before, and I didn't give you enough time, I think, to respond to, and that is you sort of rejected the premise that we are in a secularist society, or that there's this that's one of the questions, I think, that is raised, is whether or not there's this secularist agenda intent on stripping religion from the public sphere. I sense you reject that premise as well.
Well, I don't reject the premise that people are leaving organized religion, and the rise of the nuns, we call it because of a Pew Forum, has shown that there are more people identifying as atheist or agnostic or humanist, and that could be a product. And people have tried to analyze these numbers. I think that the last number was upwards of 20 to 25%. You know, a lot of those people are just not religious, and a lot of them have been people that are atheists for a long time and haven't felt comfortable identifying as such. So from the sociology standpoint, yes, there is a secularization of society, or at least people leaving religion. But from the court stand of view, from the legal side of things, what we're seeing is more, I think, because religions are reacting to that secularization of social society and are trying to, again, have more of a presence in the legal sphere. As far as secularism trying to strip religion of some rights rights that they have in the public sphere, I totally reject that. And that is a defense our opponents in litigation raise often, is when we try to take, to challenge school prayer in elementary schools at their graduations, that somehow doing so, removing prayer from the graduation program, is establishing some religion of humanism or some humanist thing. What we're asking is just for the graduation to be neutral. It's a public school. There should be no Christian prayer because the Jewish student might feel alienated or the Muslim student might feel alienated. I certainly would feel alienated as a fifth grader at my graduation if I had to stand up and pretend like I was praying just so I didn't, you know, stand out. So what we're doing as an organization and as a legal center is trying to make sure that the government remains neutral, not that it takes away religion, but that just it maintains that balance that it was intended to have between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause.
Professor Flake?
Yeah. These are studies of affiliation, not religiosity, which is what's so curious about them. The nuns, as we like to call them, because we think that's a funny joke, the people who say they have no religion typically turn out to people who don't have, they're people who don't have an organizational affiliation, but they're quite religious, even in the sense that you talk about spiritual but not religious, and I can see Reverend Peter's shaking his hand. A lot of those people go to Reverend Peter's church and to your churches, maybe not the LDS churches, but the nuns are religious. They're just not affiliated with the denomination. This creates its own set of problems in terms of governance because you have a greater multiplication of moral orders that the state must balance. But this nuns, this notion of I am religious, I am theistic, or I am spiritual, I'm just not affiliated, doesn't mean that America's less religious. To state it negatively, it means it's more incoherently religious. And that's why you're getting this great pushback against some of these laws that's so confusing to people because they look at these studies and they say, oh, America's, they say they're not religious, but everybody's in an uproar about this question. Because they're religious. They're just not in a religion.
What I think, I mean, first of all, like, there's no consensus on what those numbers reflect. But even accepting as true that, say, half of them are theistic but not, you know, identifying with a specific religion, I think what we're seeing is that governments are finally starting to recognize that not everyone does follow a religion or a scripture or a belief in God, and that they can't just ignore the atheists, that we are a group of people, we are a minority that get left out of consideration, you know, in the school prayer context, for example. And so when we have numbers that show a rising of people that aren't theistic and more people feeling comfortable, I mean, really, we kind of have to out ourselves, not in the same way as an LGBT person, but as when you say you're an atheist, it's kind of, there's still that McCarthyism, oh, an atheist. And I think more people are feeling comfortable identifying as that. And I think the government, in turn, can't, you know, we haven't had, maybe there's been three congressmen that have been openly atheists, and that was, I think Barney Frank announced it after office. He announced that he was gay long before because it was, in some respects, more acceptable to be gay than to be an atheist. And he announced it after the fact. And so, I think that with those numbers, it at least tells government that they can't ignore our voices. And I think that's a positive thing.
Let me invoke another thing that Alexander Dushku said yesterday in his presentation. He said it's in our DNA as a country to get along. These disputes are not going away, so we'll need to find a way to do that, to get along. How do we do that? Professor Flake, you want to start?
I don't like the phrase, that's a declaration of war. I think it reminds me of, this is my age. Remember the old saying, what if we had a war and nobody came? That's part of what I want to say here, I suppose. Yes, people get in high dudgeon about these issues. Lots of emotion running here. It doesn't mean we all have to play. I'd like to refer to something that Mrs. Oak said earlier this morning, that anger is a derivative feeling. And she spoke of it as a derivation of pain. And I think that's true. I think it's very important that we hold in our minds that we are not talking to people who are antagonists, but people in pain often. And secondly, I think anger derives from fear. I think we should be brave. I think we should believe in the country that got us this far with all these disagreements, and bring our best selves to this discussion. And when war is declared, say, we're not going to go, and just talk. And talk until we understand. This country's done it before. It will do it again if we will cooperate.
Reverend Peters, what do you say?
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, Kathleen, and I really appreciate what you had to say. I believe that we really do need to remain in dialogue, and I have been so touched and moved by this conference and the way that I have been received as an out and proud gay man and a member of the clergy. And I hope that you know, we can have continuing dialogue that doesn't exacerbate the hurt on both sides and therefore exacerbate the anger. I too was struck by Sister Oak's comments on that, that anger is a derivative of hurt. And I agree with Kathleen of fear. And I know that George Weinberg, in his book Society and the Healthy Homosexual, which came out in the 1970s, he defined the term homophobia as the irrational fear and or hatred of homosexuals and or homosexuality. You know, I think there is a lot of fear of us. And I think there's a lot of fear on our part of Mormons and evangelicals. And I think the only way we're going to get through that fear and therefore through the anger is to remain in dialogue and to be with each other in faith and with grace and civility.
Monica Miller?
Sure. I mean, I sort of echo both of your statements that having a greater understanding of where someone else is coming from, I think, is sort of necessary to moving on. And I think having conferences like this really do help, because you kind of go in with your expectations and your biases and thinking, oh, you know, there's not going to be people, you know, representing my views. And you kind of learn that, no, I might be wrong, and that you know, reasonable minds can differ, but can also find those kind of common understandings of, well, we just all want to be treated fairly, kind of at its core, or we want the principles, underlying principles of equality, liberty, are kind of at the core of everyone's arguments. One might weigh equality over liberty, but I think we all have those sort of common goals, and I think being able to extrapolate those and not see it as a war, not see it as me against you, but as, okay, let's sort of mediate this and look at our goals and try to find a solution rather than fighting to get more than you want just so you can kind of have the middle ground, I guess.
And Michael Yeoman, you finally.
Yeah, I would only add this footnote that we can all lower our voices. I agree with that, including my own. I would also rope in the Supreme Court on that, and nothing would be better for the furthering of dialogue than for the majority of the court to lower its antagonistic rhetoric toward people who do not share its opinion.
That's Professor Michael Yeoman of Claremont Graduate University. We also heard from Kathleen Flake with the University of Virginia, the Reverend Steve Peters, and Monica Miller, Senior Counsel with the American Humanist Association. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program was recorded and engineered by Elaine Clark. Our thanks to Tony Jordan and the staff at Claremont School of Theology's Mudd Theater for the technical support. And special thanks to Patrick Mason, who is Chair of Mormon Studies in the Religion Department at Claremont Graduate University. Claremont was the host, of course, of this weekend's conference on religious freedom in the 21st century. Our program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.